Nearing nightfall, Sophia was a hospital ship without a doctor. Boshen had guided his girl back into the smoke and fire to rescue survivors. They'd pulled from the sea 14 badly burned men and 6 more who could at least walk. The sharks were already returning to the sea what had walked on land. There was no sign of Manson Connick's body. It was going to be a long trip the rest of the way to England, and there would surely be more canvas shrouds lowered over the side. For some of those burned scarecrows, it would be the merciful thing. Boshen and Michael took a walk around the singed deck near 7 o'clock. Most of Sophia's lamps that still worked had been turned on. The crew was being fed and food was being prepared for the wounded prisoners who'd been put into one of the forward holds. A dependable pole had been named first mate and was manning the helm. A radio SOS had gone out and received a reply, and Sophia was meeting with the British freighter Arthurian for medical help and supplies around 10. Then the Russian, a good day's work done, went to eat his dinner and get some sleep. Sophia's smashed nose headed west. Above the sea, stars filled the sky.
Hey, she's not pretty, but she's tough. I think we'll make it all the way, if we have a calm sea. And if those patches hold. Maybe we can get better equipment from your British friends, eh? Come on, mon ami. I've got another bottle.
They climbed the scorched stairs to the wheelhouse, Michael following the captain. A few low lamps burned on the bridge. The first thing the two men saw was that the wheel was unmanned and Sophia was just beginning to drift off course. The second thing was that the dependable pole lay on the boards on his face with blood on the back of his sandy-haired head. The third thing they saw was a ragged and burned figure standing in the corridor. The ebony boots were not now so glossy. The figure also held a Luger. Gustav Boshen clutched at his left side. Michael had no time to draw his own weapon. He propelled himself forward. Connick suddenly showed his strength and tremendous power of will by striking Michael a hard blow between the eyes with his free fist. Dazed, Michael saw the gun rise up again. He got his own weapon. Connick stood in the doorway, his teeth bared in the dark and melted face, and fired once more as Michael crawled under the protection of the desk. Then Michael lifted the entire desk up and heaved it at Connick. Connick's head swiveled to the right. Gustav Boshen, blood blotching his shirt at left side and left shoulder, was aiming his submachine gun.
I've come to remove the garbage.
Boshen lowered his Thompson, clutched at his wounded side again, and then he too dropped. Michael emerged from the cabin and went directly to the captain's aid. He tore the shirt open to look at the wounds. 3 crewmen, alerted by the noise of gunfire, among them Dylan Custis, came rushing into the wheelhouse and gathered around Michael and the captain.
For Christ's sake, what's the fucking fuss? Haven't you ever seen a man who needs a drink?
It was a sunny morning when Sophia made harbor in Dover. The lines were thrown and secured, the anchor was dropped, and the ugliest ship that had ever crossed under the view of Dover Castle was safe. Another crew came on to unload the cargo. Several black trucks and ambulances were waiting, as well as 2 polished black sedans. Blinking in the English sun, the men walked off Sophia carrying their duffel bags and strode off along the pier, either alone or in groups. Marielle Weshauser and her family had been met by some men she knew must be important. One of them was very tall and boyish-looking, though he was probably in his late 40s. He had silvery blonde hair and pale blue eyes. He had a high forehead, so he must be smart. Freckles were scattered across his cheeks and the bridge of his crooked nose. He talked quietly to her father and kept eye contact. He seemed very cool and collected. She'd seen that same man speaking to Captain Boshen on deck not long ago, and he'd spoken that very same way. Afterward, he and Captain Boshen had shaken hands, and then Marielle had watched the Frenchman wander around the ship. It seemed he was touching everything he could, as if saying goodbye to someone he'd once loved. They were leaving now, she and her family. The important men wanted to put them in one of the black sedans and take them to a hotel in London. That would be very much fun, Marielle thought. It would be very exciting to walk around London. But first, she searched and searched. Then she searched some more. She looked everywhere, but the gentleman was gone.
Come on, Marianne. It's time.
Her father offered her his hand, as usual, to negotiate any precarious path, such as the gangplank. But she decided she didn't need his hand today. Today, she felt the sun on her face, and today, she felt so light. Because Billy was standing at the bottom, waiting for her. And when he saw her, he smiled and came up to meet her halfway. The Wolf and the Eagle.
Buckle up, Major!
The Major was already buckled up.
Sure flight today, sir!
If you say so!
Michael Gallatin occupied the rear seat of the RAF Westland Lysander aircraft. He was wearing his khaki British Western Desert Force uniform, sun-bleached and dusty, consisting of a sweat-damp short-sleeved shirt, shorts, gray knee socks, and tan-colored ankle boots. Around his neck and into his collar was tucked a dark blue scarf. It was meant to keep out the chafing grit that could lead to not only great mental distress, but to serious infection, particularly if the flies got their diggers in the wound. His officer's cap was the same color as the Libyan wasteland, the hue of the endless sand and the countless stones. Crammed into the space under his boots was his kit bag. It held a change of clothes, his canteen, his shaving accoutrements, and his dependable American Colt 45 automatic.
Well, it's fine for flying this morning, sir. No reason to worry.
Who's worried? You just tend to the flying.
The airfield at the Bir al-Khabir Oasis was a slapdash construction of tents and prefabricated buildings brought in by cargo planes from Cairo, 224 miles to the east. The scraggly palm trees around the waterhole were not pretty, and the water was not sweet. But even water that smelled and tasted of rotten eggs was life in this climate of 122 degree days. A hot wind sometimes blew in, nagging at the tents and hissing through the aircraft engines to find their weak places, as more spinning sheets of dust painted machines and men alike the blanched shade of misery. There was a war going on, and it was not always necessarily Churchill's British versus Hitler's Germans and Mussolini's Italians. Sometimes it was the Brit versus the invasion of 100,000 biting flies, or the Brit versus the month of burning days, so stunning saliva dried within seconds to white crust on the cracked lips. Or the Brits versus the empty horizon upon which heat waves threw mirages of huge lakes that shimmered like molten vats of white glass. The first of the Spitfire fighter planes was taking off. Woe to the other pilots behind him, including the Cockney kid at the Lysander's controls, due to the amount of dust the takeoff stirred up.
You must be an important chap, sir! Three Spit escort and all! Begging your pardon.
I have my uses.
Roger that. We're waiting. Over.
The pilot spoke through his headset microphone. Michael checked his Rolex watch. He figured he'd be in Cairo in time for a debriefing meeting at HQ and then on to lunch on the shaded veranda of the Piper's Club. He hadn't realized how much he missed their small fillets, a platter of orange rolls, and a fine cold beer. Two beers would be doubly fine. Then on to sleep for about 12 hours on sheets of Egyptian cotton. The second Spit took off and the dust storm had hardly settled before the final member of the fighter escort rose into the sky.
Here we go, sir! Roger. On our way. Over.
The Lysander began to roll. They were off the ground in about 10 seconds.
Going up to 15,000 today, sir. Get yourself a good look at the desert from way up there.
Another look at the desert was the last thing Michael Gallatin needed or wanted. His entire four-day mission out here had involved looking at the desert. He knew what they'd called him at the airfield. Majorly strange. That was because after every sundown, he drove through the guard's position in an open-topped Morris truck and drove back an hour before sunup. They knew that he was a reconnaissance officer, but they were puzzled as to why he went out alone. What they didn't know was that once out in the desert, at a distance of a couple of miles or more, the recon major stopped his truck, took off his uniform, folded it and put it away, and then Major Lee Strange became a creature that the word strange utterly failed to describe. Over the sand and fist-sized stones of the Hamada, he ran westward on four legs, and cloaked by the night, he traveled mile upon mile to make note in his human mind of the brutal landscape. The soft pits of sand that could swallow a truck or a tank, the series of dunes that would turn a soldier's legs and willpower to jelly, the vast flat plains stubbled with cactus that rose to mountains and fell off again into chasms of jagged red rock. He was searching also for the German mines that lay in their thousands under the sand or the stony crust, and these he could smell by the metallic tang of danger that thrust at him snake-like as he approached. His job was to find a path for the British Army to move westward and destroy the Afrika Korps siege of Tobruk, which had trapped over 24,000 Commonwealth soldiers in a ring of steel since the 10th of April.
Easy peasy, lemon squeezy!
They had taken up their position just behind and below two Spitfires, with the third guarding their tail. They flew east. The Lysander's engine noise became a dull rumble. Michael didn't care to sightsee what his sight had already seen, so he closed his eyes and tried to rest. Yesterday had happened one of those rare encounters that made life, to Michael, such an interesting mystery. Such things could not be written in books and be believed. He'd been walking to his quarters after he'd sent the radio codes when someone had fallen into step beside him.
Excuse me, sir. Major?
Yes?
The young corporal wore a dusty Western Desert Force uniform. He saluted. Michael returned the salute and then smiled and offered his hand. The young man took it.
Oh, I thought it was you, sir. Our company pulled in for water a while ago, sir. May I ask, what are you doing here?
On duty.
Oh, yes. Of course. Well, I felt I had to do my duty too, sir, with all that's going on. She asked if I wouldn't rather have joined the Navy, but I told her I've had enough of the sea. We were married last April, sir, Mariel and I. 3 years to the day we met.
Billy, that's wonderful to hear.
Oh, thank you, sir. I think she's pretty wonderful myself.
I have no doubt. Your company's heading east?
Yes, sir, we're being pulled back. Last night we ran into some pretty stiff opposition. A few jerry tanks out looking for trouble.
The Major and the Corporal talked for a few minutes, and then it was time for Billy to return to his men.
Goodbye, sir.
They saluted each other, and they went on. At 15,000 feet above the desert, Michael had a dream of a wolf tumbling from the sky.
Everything all right?
Fine, sir. Just relax.
Michael checked his watch. A grand total of 19 minutes had passed since they'd left the airfield.
Oh, key Royst!
One of the Spitfires veered away and dove to the right. Through the plexiglass canopy, Michael saw the glint of metal rising from the earth. Two airplanes? They were coming up fast from about 12,000 feet. He made out the shapes of Messerschmitt BF-109s, painted in desert camouflage hues. The one in the lead had a solid black tail with the Nazi symbol painted in white upon it.
Jesus! Oh, Jesus!
Then the black-tailed 109 flashed past between the Lysander and the second Spit on its way to a higher altitude. The Spitfire behind Michael's plane took after it.
Steady!
The second BF-109 came up firing. Tracers zipped across the sky. The remaining Spitfire on point tipped its wings over and fell away. Michael saw it roll in order to get a position behind the 109 as it passed. The Spitfire's wing guns sparkled, and again, tracers reached out for the target but fell short. Michael looked out the canopy to his left and saw that the black-tailed 109 had gotten to the rear of the first Spitfire and was gaining on it. The Spit jinked to the right. The Messerschmitt followed. German tracers shot out in a pattern that might be called beautiful in any other situation, and as the Spit jinked to the left, bullets caught it and tore pieces of metal from the fuselage. The Spit dove, and the black-tailed 109 dove after it, even as the third Spitfire got on the 109's rear and hung there at incredible speed.
That's Rolf Gant, 109! We're getting out!
The Lysander nosed down with an effect that lifted Michael off his seat and made the belt feel as if it were slicing him in two. They went down fast. Suddenly, something was coming down faster. The burning front half of a Spitfire, its wings and fuselage pierced by machine gun bullets and fist-sized 20mm cannon rounds. It fell past the Lysander, its control cables dangling from the torn-away rear half, and the black-tailed 109 turned away from the tumbling wreckage. Michael watched the Messerschmitt evade tracers from the Spit on its tail. The aircraft was ascending again, and suddenly it cut its speed and rolled to the left, and the Spit went past it just a little too far. As the Spitfire tried to correct its course, the black-tailed 109 made a complete roll and came up shooting at the Spit's belly. Michael craned his neck to see the third Spitfire fighting for its life in a battle with one German Eagle, and then the black-tailed Ace joined the fray. The planes crisscrossed each other, but in a matter of seconds, the 109 with the camouflage-painted tail made a mistake of timing and ran into a line of slugs that floated sinuously across the sky.
Down, baby, down!
The remaining Spitfire and the Messerschmitt came down twisting and turning around each other. Michael watched, transfixed, as their pilots battled for position. Tracers hit empty air that had not been empty the second before. A collision was narrowly missed. One plane zoomed upward and one shrieked down. Michael realized, with dry mouth and feverish brain, that the black-tailed 109 was turning toward them in an elegant curve, and it was going to get them in its gun sights. The Cockney pilot abruptly chopped the throttle and turned the plane on its side to fall to the left, but the tracers were upon them and there was nowhere to hide. Michael smelled scorched metal and fresh blood. Michael Gallatin was stretched up against the belt 1 second, and the next he was smashed into the seat. The Lysander was tumbling down. The Spit had taken some damage and smoke was curling from the engine. Rolf Gant's plane bore a dozen bullet holes along the fuselage. The two combatants went at each other again, head to head and guns blazing. In the middle of another roll, Michael's bloodshot eyes saw Gant's 109 lose a section of its right wing in a burst of flying metal, but an instant later the German's bullets hit home. The entire front of the Spitfire exploded.
Got it, sir!
The Cockney pilot fought to gain control of his aircraft. Michael was near passing out himself. The blood swelled in his face and roared in his ears.
Got it, sir!
And then, quite suddenly, he did have it. The Lysander righted itself. They were still going down fast onto a terrain of yellow sand and black rocks about 1,000 feet below. The pilot pulled back on his yoke and the nose came up.
Got it, sir!
An extended wheel hit the Lysander's left wing and knocked the bulky airplane through the sky. Michael saw the belly of Gant's 109 pass overhead. Fire was licking around the motionless prop. The Messerschmitt headed down. Again, the young pilot fought for control. This time it was obvious he was almost done. When Michael dared to look to the left, he saw the wing on that side torn to tatters.
Can you get out, sir?
Put us down!
Yes, sir!
He cut all power and lowered whatever flap was still working. He moved with slow and maybe dying deliberation. The Lysander began to turn on the side of its disabled wing. The ground was rising to meet them. It was all sand shiny and hard angles of rock. Michael judged 100 feet to go. He braced, as if bracing would do any good.
We're in for it, sir!
When at last the Lysander ceased its motion, Michael Gallatin was facing westward. Smoke was starting to fill the cockpit. He had to get out. His left arm was numb. He tried to move it. He got his seatbelt unbuckled with his right hand. He unlocked the canopy and shoved the cracked plexiglass open. He flung his kit bag from the plane. Then he climbed up and tumbled over the side onto the stony ground. Small flames were starting to curl up around the engine from beneath the wrecked plane.
Get out!
The young pilot didn't move. Michael realized the fire was growing. He had to get the pilot out. He stood up, stumbled, and righted himself. He got hold of one of the metal reinforcement strips that ran along the pilot's canopy to flip it up. His right arm strained, but the thing was locked tight from within. He banged on the blood-spattered plexiglass. The pilot stirred, turned his head to display the gore that had streamed in a torrent from his mouth, and stared numbly at Michael Gallatin. The front of the pilot's shirt was red, where at least one bullet had hit him in the chest.
Unlock it! Unlock your canopy!
The pilot just stared at Michael, his swollen eyes heavy-lidded. The engine burst into flames.
Unlock your canopy!
A gout of red flame jumped into the pilot's cabin. Before Michael's eyes, he became ablaze, and one crisped hand reached up to press feebly against the blackening canopy. Then it fell back into the flames. And what looked like a swarm of 1,000 glowing red bees swept around and around at the center of ashes and smoke. At a distance away from the conflagration, Michael sat down on the ground like a boy before a summertime campfire. He felt himself let go, because he had nowhere to get to in a hurry. Then the darkness came upon him as suddenly as if the sun had gone out.
Hey, Englisher! Are you dead?
The toe of a boot prodded Michael's side. He sat up and saw the gun pointed in his face.
Easy. Do nothing fast. As if you could. Friend, you're in one hell of a condition.
Michael looked up at his visitor. The man wore a tan-colored short-sleeved shirt open to show his white undershirt and a pair of tan-colored trousers tucked into dusty black boots. On the pocket of his shirt was pinned his Iron Cross and his Luftwaffe's airman's badge. He was an example of the handsome Nordic breed, with the tousled blonde hair of a wild little boy and sardonic amber eyes that belonged to a worldly wise man. He was of compact, powerful build, with a chiseled face, a hooked nose, and a firm jaw, and he stood about 5'10". Behind the man, maybe 2 miles away, Michael could see the black smoke rising from another aircraft wreck. This pilot had not come down with his ship, however, for he still carried his parachute pack slung over one shoulder, and folded up within it could be seen the white chute itself.
Name?
Gallatin.
Gant. This is yours.
He motioned quickly with a tilt of his head toward the open kit bag on the ground a few feet away. Michael figured the man must have carried it over from beside the still-burning Lysander, since it was scorched by flames. Michael nodded. It had been gone through. Michael noted his Colt automatic in Gant's waistband under the outer shirt. Michael's change of clothes was scattered around, and the canteen with its black leather shoulder strap lay atop his second pair of shorts.
Unfortunately, most of the water was lost, but I did squeeze some back into the canteen from your clothes.
Gant frowned and glanced toward a third plume of black smoke many miles away.
The talented bastard who shot me down had a superb Immelmann, but he was not quite so good at his snap roll. What was his name?
I don't know. I'm not a flyer.
No, you're a faller. You should feel lucky you're not dead. Most who tangle with me end up that way.
Do most who tangle with you not have guns on their planes? What was the point of shooting down the Lysander?
You got between me and the spit. The bullets go where they go. Now it's time for us to go. So see the smoke and come looking. Stand up.
No.
What did I hear, Englisher?
I said no, meaning I'm not standing up. You go you please, but I'm staying here.
Are you? I can hurt you a little more, you see.
Go ahead. I'll just bleed some and wait for the RAF to arrive. As you say, they'll see the smoke and come looking.
I didn't mean your Air Force will come looking. You're too far from your base and you're off the regular patrol route. I'm talking about the Dalasifa, the Death Stalkers. You have heard of them, yes?
Michael had heard rumors. Supposedly, the Dalasifa was a warlike tribe of scavengers who stripped corpses of anything valuable after a battle.
They're real enough. They usually travel in packs of 6 or 7. They're in their territory. They'll see the smoke and they'll come looking to strip corpses. And they won't care who's wearing what uniform either, or how close to being a corpse you are. They'll finish that job. What's the brand of your watch?
Rolex.
Breitling.
Gant showed Michael the watch on a brown leather band on his wrist.
I intend to keep it, and my arm. Shall we go?
Michael thought about it, but not for very long. The Lysander, burning to its metal framework, cast no shade. The world was made up of yellow sand, black rock, and white glaring sun. It was a furnace. He stood up.
Carry your bag. And oh yes, I have your nice straight razor in my pocket, if you're wondering. I'll carry the canteen, but you should put those clothes back in your bag as well. They might be useful.
Michael did what he suggested.
Your left arm's broken?
Possibly. Whatever, it's not working.
Bind it up.
Michael spent a moment getting the dark blue collar scarf tied around his neck and then forcing the arm into it. He picked up the kit bag, moving as slowly as a hobbled old man.
Go! This way!
It was no surprise to Michael that Rolf Gant, the German Messerschmitt ace who, since the beginning of his career in the 1939 invasion of Poland, had shot down 46 enemy planes, and now added 4 more credits to that number, wished to head toward the German lines instead of toward the British in Cairo. Michael walked, carrying the kit bag. Gant held the pistol on him for a while, but then lowered it to save his arm strength. Michael knew exactly what Gant wanted, to find a German patrol or outpost as soon as possible, to give up his prisoner and maybe get a truck ride back to his airfield. Then it was off to a POW camp for Michael Gallatin, and it would be a very long war for a caged lycanthrope. They hadn't gone very far when it was obvious to Michael that they weren't going to get very far. His shadow upon the stony Hamada was the blackest ink. The sun drove a white-hot spike into his head. He was already craving water, and the flies had found them. Found their wounds, to be more exact.
The survival manual says the first thing to do is get your head and face covered. Then only travel at night.
The survival manual doesn't have Dollar Sifa in it. We'll keep going for a while.
As they walked, he opened the canteen and took a quick drink.
Here. One swallow only.
Michael took the offered canteen. The water tasted of his laundry soap. He returned the cap to the canteen and the canteen to Gant, who returned the strap to his shoulder.
Keep walking.
You're sure you'll find anything out there?
I have a very good sense of direction.
So do I. But that doesn't mean you'll find an outpost before you run out of water.
Michael stopped walking.
Go on. Don't stop.
I'm putting something over my head. And you stop waving that damned gun around. Does it look like I'm in any shape to give you trouble?
No. I suppose not.
Michael put the kit bag down amid the stones and knelt beside it. He found his small bottle of Trumpeter Lime aftershave, thankfully neither broken by a bullet nor the impact. It had enough alcohol in it to heal small razor cuts. It would do as well as anything on wounds suffered in an aircraft crash. Working with one hand, he got the bottle open and splashed liquid on the cut over his eye. He rubbed more of the liquid all over his face and felt small stings from chin to forehead.
You English. That's why you won't win this war, you know. You're too addicted to your comfort and your little... What is that? Aftershave lotion?
That's right.
Michael screwed the small crown cap back on.
Here.
He threw it to Gant, who caught it by reflex in his left hand.
The alcohol will help.
I don't choose to smell like a small British island in the Caribbean. Don't you people take this war seriously?
Michael decided to ignore the man. He brought a tan-colored shirt out of the kit bag. Shaking the flies off his wounds, he tore the shirt in a couple of strategic places and began to wrap it around his head and face in his best approximation of a desert tribesman keffiyeh.
Take, for example, your tea breaks. Why does everything stop at a certain hour for your people to drink tea? You even stop during an advance to drink tea. Don't you understand the value of discipline?
I don't stop for tea breaks, but I think they are a form of discipline.
You Englishers are children living in a dream world.
And I suppose you Nazis are living in the real world.
I'm not a Nazi. Never a Nazi.
Gant shrugged off the canteen and the parachute pack.
What's your first name?
Michael.
All right, Michael. I will shoot you if you move in any way in the next 2 minutes. The bullet will go into your knee, and it will be a crippling shot because I am a very good shot. Then, though I desire to take you back as my prisoner, I will leave you here to die. Do you understand that?
Michael nodded. Gant removed his shirt and pulled his undershirt up over his face. He positioned it so he could see through the neck hole and his head was covered. And then he put his shirt back on and retrieved the other gear.
Very obedient of you. And very smart. You're a major, I see. But you wear no other insignia. What's your specialty?
Reconnaissance.
Ah. So you're used to walking the untrodden path, is that correct? After you.
The sun was their enemy. Scorpions scuttled amid the stones at their feet. As he trudged onward, Michael realized only his physical training, and perhaps his supernatural training, was keeping him on his feet. The wind strengthened and swirled sand before it. Grit stung the eyes like sharp bits of glass.
Don't slow down.
I need some water.
So do I, but we don't get any. Not yet.
Michael continued to slow his pace and put a small stumble in it for effect.
Water.
If he could manage to knock that gun from Gant's hand. But there was the Colt automatic in the man's waistband. Whatever happened in the next few seconds, it was going to be a dirty, close run. Gant aimed the pistol at the ground between them.
Don't try what you're thinking. You will be much too clumsy. So just keep walking like a good, obedient...
He suddenly spun to the right and held the pistol out before him. Michael looked in that direction. A figure stood up on a slight hill at the edge of the curtains of blowing sand. It was a small figure, dressed in dirty clothes that may have once been white. They were really not much more than rags that flapped in the wind. The figure wore a brown keffiyeh, and on top of that sat a khaki-colored Scottish tam-o'-shanter cap, which Michael knew was a common headdress among Commonwealth soldiers.
Come down here!
The figure did not move.
Do you know the language?
A little.
Tell him to come down here.
Tati Elohuna!
The figure turned and ran, and in a few seconds was gone from sight.
What do you make of that?
When Michael had no reply, the pistol found him once more.
Keep moving. And no more play-acting, please. You're no stumbler.
Michael walked forward, with Gant a careful few paces behind.
Entertain me. Tell me about yourself.
I wouldn't care to waste my breath.
Fair enough. I'll tell you about myself, then. Did you know that I've shot down... Well, it would be 50 planes, including the ones today. 50. Did you know how many pilots have never shot down even one plane? And here I have 50 chalked up. What do you say about that?
I say you're walking through the desert, same as me.
Yes, but there's a very big difference between our futures. You'll be a prisoner of war, and I'll be up there again. I belong up there, Michael. It's where I truly live. Is there a place you truly live?
No particular place.
I'm sorry for you, then. All men need a place where they truly live, where their souls and spirits are free. The sky is my place. I find it beautiful, even on a stormy day when the planes are grounded. It is a woman with a thousand faces, all of them exquisite. Are you married, Michael?
No.
Nor am I. As if I should ever wear such a chain. The first thing a wife would say to me is, don't fly so high or so fast. And listening to her and wanting to please her would kill me as it has killed so many other pilots with attachments. Men like us don't need attachments, do we?
Men like us?
The risk takers! The men who must be on the battlefront! Take you for one. Your reconnaissance work. That puts you at great risk, doesn't it? And you're out front, blazing a trail through the mines and tank traps. Don't tell me you're simply a desk jockey, because I won't believe it.
I'm not simply that.
A man of action can recognize a man of action. It's in the way you move, and you're confident. Even now, even with your broken shoulder, that I'll never get you to that outpost, aren't you? Even with a pistol at your back, you're confident. You think I'll make a mistake you can take advantage of, yes? And I'm confident that I will not make a mistake. So what does that make us?
Two confident fools in the desert, with a couple of swallows of water and a shot-up canteen.
No! It makes us comrades of sorts. Like chess players, you see? Two men of action, reduced to the barest minimum to survive. A challenge to be overcome.
I think you need some more covering for your head.
Maybe I do, Englisher. But I'll tell you, I find your confidence in this situation to be very interesting and entertaining. I'm just waiting to see what you're going to do to keep yourself out of a POW camp. Because I know you're going to try.
You would?
Of course I would. I'd never give up trying. And that's why we're comrades of sorts, isn't it?
If you say so.
A movement to the right caught Michael's attention. When he looked, he saw across the white plain the small figure in the dirty rags and the khaki tam about 100 meters away, keeping their pace.
Ah, there he is again. Now, he's not a Dalasifa scout, or he'd be on a camel. In fact, why isn't he on a camel? I make him out to be about 4'6". A small boy, I'm thinking. All alone out here. And why might that be?
If you want to find out, offer him water.
And use up even a swallow of what we have? Now who needs his head covered a little better?
If he's a native, he might know where a well is. In fact, he may be on his way there. So, one swallow of water for him could wind up filling the canteen. Once we get a decent plug in the hole.
All right. Tell him we have water.
Michael abruptly stopped, and Gant pulled himself up short, then backed away a couple of steps. Out across the plain, the small boy also stopped and stared in their direction.
Lady Nalma!
There was no response.
Hold up the canteen.
Gant did so, no response. The figure just stood there, staring.
He's not coming in. Let's go.
For the next hour, the figure stayed with them at a distance of never less than 100 meters. They came upon an area of sand dunes that rose up in tremendous golden waves. What looked like piles of burned black rubble lay about. Michael and Gant, at the same time, saw the footprints leading from the hard, stony surface up one of the dunes and over. Someone was walking ahead of them. The small figure had vanished. When they reached the top of the first dune, they saw the person who'd made the footprints struggling onward about 200 meters ahead. It was a man in tan-colored clothes and wearing black boots. He had wrapped a dark green kerchief around his head. He fell and stood up, fell again and stood up again, and kept going.
Oh my God, I think that's Hartler, my wingman. He's wearing on his head the scarf his wife sent him.
Before Gant could shout, a piece of black rubble hit him on the right shoulder. At the same time, Michael saw six men on camels come up over a dune and surround Gant's wingman. Hartler fell to his knees. All the six men carried rifles, and one who seemed to be in the lead, a man wearing robes dyed bright crimson and a keffiyeh of the same vivid hue, aimed his rifle at Hartler's head.
Get down!
Both of them watched over the dune's rise at the scene as it unfolded, and both knew they were in the presence of the Dalla Sifa. Two of the other men threw ropes around Hartler. Hartler pitched forward. His body was dragged between a pair of camels off across the sand and away. Neither Gant nor Michael moved for some time. The Walther was clutched in Gant's hand, and the hand was there within Michael's reach. Michael grabbed up a handful of sand. Grappling for the gun, they slid halfway down the massive dune. In that instant, his teeth began to lengthen. He could feel them bursting free from the gums. Small hairs rose up on the back of his right hand and along the arm, and the fingers began to change their shape. Gant's knee crashed into his jaw.
Do you think you're clever? So damned clever. You're a fool is what you are. I should shoot you. One bullet to your brain and I'm finished with you.
If shooting me is worth bringing them back after they hear the noise, then go ahead.
Gant's attention was suddenly diverted from Michael Gallatin.
What the hell do you want?
Michael turned his head to see the boy in the dirty clothes, the brown keffiyeh, and the khaki tam standing there next to the rubble pile he must have been hiding in. Michael surmised that the boy had seen the Dalla Sifa first, and he'd thrown a piece of rock at Gant to keep the flyer from calling Hartler and getting them all killed.
Ask him what he wants.
My veterano!
What's wrong with him? Can't he speak?
The boy lifted his right hand and made a chopping motion across where his mouth would be under the keffiyeh. Michael got up and walked to the boy. He was about 10, with curly black hair and olive-hued skin and dark, sunken eyes that had seen things no boy of 10 should have ever witnessed. They were so full of misery and the shadows of sadness that they were frightening to peer into. The boy opened his mouth.
Ah, his tongue's been cut out. Looks recent.
What do you think happened to him?
War between tribes, I'm supposing. Maybe the Dalla Sifa raided his village. Could be they left him alive and moved his tongue as a warning. Maybe he'd befriended a Commonwealth soldier, and the Dalla Sifa didn't like that.
Damn it.
Michael noticed something the boy was doing with his left hand. It was balled up, and he kept shaking it back and forth. Michael reached out and prodded the hand to get him to open it. The boy resisted for a few seconds, the solemn dark eyes revealing nothing. Then the hand opened. In the palm was a pair of yellowed dice with red pips. The boy closed his hand almost at once and kept shaking the dice within.
Give him some water.
Say, you don't order me around.
Water.
Gant uncapped the flask, stepped forward, and gave it to the boy. The boy drank. One sip under the keffiyeh and one sip only. He knew from the amount of water in the canteen how desperate their situation was. He handed it back to Gant, who had already gotten his head covering, back into an orderly position. Michael was running out of phrases in the local dialect.
Berharib.
The boy made a motion with his right hand like a bird taking flight. He ended it with a finger pointing to the southwest.
What are you saying to him?
Asking him if there's a well nearby. He's saying, I think, that it's a distance away to the southwest.
How far?
He couldn't tell me.
I intend for us to continue our present course.
All right. We probably each have one swallow remaining. Continue your present course. I'm going with the boy to find a well.
Pardon me?
Use the gun or put it down. I'm going with this boy to find a well. But I'm not going to let you walk me into a POW camp. Yes, I thought I could get away. Now I know I can't trick you or beat you. My compliments. But my time is running out. Yours also. I suggest you take the last of the water and continue your course. You might find a patrol or an outpost later this afternoon, or tonight, or tomorrow. You might run into the Dalasifa. You have 2 guns, you can hold them off for a while, or you might run into a British patrol, and then you can sit out the rest of the war, but unfortunately the sky will not wait. Whatever you decide to do, Rolf, it's your day. Isn't it lovely?
You're out of your mind!
No, I've come to my senses. No man will force me to do anything, certainly not on what may very well likely be the last day of my life. So as they say, lead, follow, or get the hell out of my way.
Michael turned his attention to the boy.
Elbir, chuv mi hunaika.
The boy began to walk toward the southwest. Michael followed. Gant stood at a crossroads, though beneath him there was only shifting and uncertain sand. He watched the 2 figures, the small and the tall, walk away from him. He gazed along his present course, further to the northwest, where he hoped he might find his brothers in arms. He let the pistol drop to his side.
If they run into the Dalasifa, they're going to need me.
He began to follow the 2 figures, the small and the tall, across the golden dunes toward the far horizon. In the shadow of a rough mound of red rock, carved by the Sahara's wind into a spidery shape more suited for an exhibit of Picasso's bronze sculptures, the 3 wanderers rested. They were all arranged in various positions on the parachute, which had been laid down to shield their bodies from the heat radiating off the hard surface beneath. The boy, sitting a distance away with his knees up to his chin, stared straight ahead through his slit of brown cloth, the tam on his head pale with dust. There was no longer a need for Gant to brandish a gun. The Colt had gone into his parachute pack and the Walther into his waistband. They were all equals now, and all equally tired and thirsty.
Hartler was a good man. He was a very efficient wingman. Trust is an important quality, isn't it, Michael?
Michael's eyes opened. This was a new avenue of approach.
Yes, it is.
I trusted Hartler with my life. Many, many times. He had a wife and 2 beautiful daughters. I told him, Hartler, give this up and go home. Tell them you have a family that you wish to live for. And you know what he answered. He said he would go home when he was as big a hero as me. A hero. And I am, I suppose. No, I know I am. The letters in the newspapers, they say I am. Signal said it in 3 issues. A shining light for the youth of Germany, for her future and her aspirations. But let me tell you, let me please tell you what the life of a hero is. It's 100 flashbulbs going off in your face, but not 1 light on in your apartment when you get home. It's vows of undying love, faithful loyalty, and reckless sex, but not 1 plate of a home-cooked meal. It's the look on a young man's face when he tells you he too wants to be an eagle. And you have already seen so many faces of young men burnt beyond human recognition. I am the hero who finds the weakness in weaker men. I am the hero who strikes from below, who gives no quarter and expects none. And to tell you the honest truth, Michael, I smile a little bit when the chutes fail to open. For the hero has done his work that day. He has done his work. But oh, dear God, I do love the sky.
Gant shifted his position against the rock. Michael saw him lift his left arm and regard his wristwatch.
Your Rolex. A nice play toy, but it can't compare with a Breitling.
Is that so?
Absolutely so. Well, just look at the difference. Mine has an automatic winder and a chronograph. In fact, it's been created specifically for use by aviators. I've had not a bit of trouble with any part of it in the 4 happy years of ownership. And your Rolex may be very handsome, if that's what you feel you need to project, but it doesn't have the pedigree of the Breitling. The Breitling brand dates from 1884. I believe the Rolex name was trademarked in 1908. Breitling has 24 years of experience on the Rolex. What do you say to that?
I'd say Rolex caught up very quickly to Breitling and surpassed that brand in short order. They learn from Breitling's mistakes.
Oh, really? And how exactly has Rolex surpassed Breitling?
In the areas of waterproofing and shockproofing.
A Rolex was worn by the first British woman to swim the English Channel in October of 1927. You can imagine how cold the water was.
Yes. Unfortunately, I can only imagine.
After 10 hours in the water, her Rolex was still performing perfectly. As for the area of shockproofing, my Rolex is still performing perfectly after, you may recall, this morning's airplane crash.
Ah, touché. But my Breitling still beats your Rolex, beats it by far.
And why is that?
Because of the band. This leather band, you see it? This band is made from the leather on the instrument panel of my father's Albatross fighter plane from 1918. He died in action, but he set his plane down first. A perfect landing, they said, and him shot full of holes. His wingman sent my mother a drawing of him that one of his squadron members had done. It was framed in the plane's wing fabric and panel leather. After my mother passed away, I decided I wanted my father to be closer to me than a picture on the wall. I decided I wanted him to fly with me. And here he is.
Michael had never had such difficulty getting to his feet, but he made it.
I think we
should... Oh!
Gant jerked his head away from the rock and grasped at the back of his neck.
Scheiße! Something stung me!
Michael looked at the rock and saw a trace of movement in a shadow pool. Peering closer, he made out the 3-inch-long black scorpion that sat there, its stinger coiled back and ready to deliver another strike.
Scorpion.
Gant drew the Walther and smashed its grip into the shadow pool until the scorpion was a mass of milky paste. Then he looked at Michael with terror in his eyes.
Razor.
Gant pulled Michael's straight razor from his pocket and gave it to him. He leaned forward. Michael opened the razor and found the sting just to the right of Gant's vertebrae. It was a small red puncture wound, already becoming ringed with white. Michael cut an X across the wound and squeezed the blood out of it.
Did you get it all?
Michael got down on his knees beside the flyer.
Hold still.
He sliced another X into the flesh beside the first. Then Michael put his mouth over the wound and sucked the blood like any good vampire in a Bram Stoker horror story. That was all he could do.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know if I got all of it.
All right. Thank you. You tried.
We'd better stay here a while longer. Just be still.
Yes. As you say, yes.
Gant crawled away from the rock. He lay down on the parachute on his right side, trailing blood as it dripped. He curled up into a fetal position with his hands folded under his right cheek. An hour passed, during which the sun dropped to the horizon. The light turned deeper red with blue shadows. The air cooled as night came on.
I'm burning up. Burning up.
He sat up, and in the red gloom, Michael saw the glistening of small beads of sweat on the man's ashen face.
Can I have some water?
We have none.
I must have water. My mouth, it's not right.
We have no water.
I'm burning up.
Rolf, just lie down and...
I must insist on water. Would you deny a thirsty man?
Listen to me. Do you know where you are?
I'm... Yes. I'm in the infirmary. I remember. I was flying. Then there was oil on my windscreen. I couldn't see. I knew I was going down. I jumped and my parachute opened. What happened to my plane?
It crashed.
The lights. Why are the lights so dim?
Lie down. Right there. On the bed.
I don't like it. So dark in here.
Some of the scorpion's poison had gotten into his system, Michael knew. From what he'd read, there were 30 different varieties of scorpions in the Sahara, and 4 of them were lethal to humans. The one that had stung Gant was toxic as a cobra. The venom could first cause high fever and hallucinations, then convulsions, and finally heart failure. It just depended on how much Michael had been able to get out of the wound.
Yes, I think I will lie down.
He curled himself up again on his side on the parachute, and he closed his eyes. A few minutes passed. Gant appeared to be sleeping, his chest rising and falling. He twitched suddenly, but it was a passing muscle spasm. Then he opened his eyes and sat up again, and now he glowered at Michael with an expression nearing rage.
I said I need water! It is very uncivilized to keep water from a thirsty man! Do you hear me, sir?
Rolf, there's no more water.
You can't treat your patients in this manner! These men here, they all deserve better, sir! They shouldn't be so disrespected! I want water for all of us, now!
Very well, then. You'll get it. There's a jug under the bed. Right there.
Reach under and bring it out.
Gant stared blankly at him.
Under the bed. Right there.
Thank you, sir.
He leaned over to get the imaginary jug under the phantom bed. Michael plucked the Walter from Gant's waistband. Michael hit him as lightly as possible across the back of the head with the pistol's grip. Gant lay on the parachute. His body began to convulse, the arms and legs twisting. This hideous phase lasted about 15 minutes before Gant suddenly became still. Michael checked his pulse. Weak, but the man was alive. The night turned cooler. Michael's Rolex showed the passage of almost 3 more hours before Gant stirred and got slowly up on his hands and knees.
Damn, my head hurts.
After that, he curled down again in a fetal position and went to sleep. They reached the well when dawn was a thin streak of red across the horizon and the world was made of different depths of darkness. The well was not pretty. It lay up under an outcropping of rock and so was shielded from the sun. Uneven stones were built up around a small pool the size of a bathtub in a cheap hotel. Dried animal dung was scattered about where the jackals and wild dogs had unsuccessfully tried to mark their territory. Pretty or not, the well was full of gorgeous water. Gant's cracked lips parted in a gasp of need, and he flung himself forward past Michael and the boy. He hung over the stones and pushed his face into the water. He reached in with both arms and splashed water over his head. He reached down deeper into the cooler depths. Came back up, Michael saw the entrails roped around them. And suddenly, the gashed open, bloodless torso that the entrails had spilled from surfaced in front of Gant's face, and also bursting to the surface was a decapitated human head, mouth and eyes open, and bearing the purple hole of a rifle bullet. Michael approached the well. He had already smelled the beginnings of putrefaction. Desert heat was not kind to a corpse. By the end of another day, the odor would even keep the animals from coming near. There was another scent in the air also, salt. He figured the water had been salted as well as fouled by human remains. He walked a few paces away and knelt down on his haunches to think. He thought he understood the motive for this brutality.
The Dalasifa. They've poisoned this well to keep the other tribes from drinking it. Their own village must not be far. They've likely got a well there. They're probably demanding tribute from some other tribes. We need water or we're going to die. Stand up.
I can't.
If you won't stand up, I'll stand you up.
Please, let me lie here. I can't. Dear God, I can't.
Gant was interrupted by the hand that reached down and grasped the back of his collar, pulling his face out of the sand.
You hear me? Loud and clear. You can handle a gun. So can I. The guns can get us some water. That means we live, at least for another day. Unless the Dalasifa kill us first. But I'm thinking they're not going to be expecting two men with guns. I told you to stand up.
I'm done. You go.
The odds are not good for one man. Not much better for two, but they are better. Now, you're a soldier and so am I. I go out fighting, do you hear me?
I can't make it, please. I'm done.
I'll tell you when you're done or not. We have to try. We can think of something.
I'm too weak. I can barely walk.
Can you crawl?
Gant lowered his hands and looked up at Michael Gallatin. His eyes were deep sunken, dull, and lifeless. Michael reached into the parachute pack, got the Walther P-38, and offered the weapon to its owner.
Take it. Go ahead and blow your brains out if you want to. I'll bury you out here, or you can join Hartla for a long bath.
Why would I want to commit suicide?
It would be faster than dying of thirst. You still have some strength left. The village may be only a few miles away. Their well will be clean. If I have to die today, I want to die fighting to live.
That makes not a bit of sense.
I know. It's one of your quotes from your last article in Signal.
You're a strange bastard.
Save your insults for tomorrow. For today, take this pistol. I'm thirsty enough to kill for a drink. Are you?
Yes, I am.
They aimed themselves along the camel tracks, with Michael leading the way, the boy next, and then Gant. As the sun steadily rose and the heat intensified, the Englisher and German stopped to put on their face and head coverings, and then they continued southward. It was difficult for even Michael to keep moving as the heat grew, so he knew Gant was struggling. Every so often, Michael looked back at the others. The boy was all right, though moving slowly, but Gant was losing ground. At last, as the sun began to sink down again toward the blue world of another night, as the jackals that followed them came sniffing in close for the smell of impending death, but did not find it yet, and so retreated to wait a few hours more, the three figures crouched on a ridge of rock and surveyed what lay ahead. Michael had seen it first and cautioned the others to be careful in their approach. He didn't want the watchmen atop the wooden tower to see them. The man, wearing the traditional robes and a keffiyeh, held a pair of binoculars. The man stood beneath an awning of tan-colored cloth that might have been the shirts of several dead soldiers stitched together, and hanging on a rope behind him was a horn he could blow into to alert the inhabitants of the village at his back. But for the camel trail that passed along the watchman's tower, the village was encircled by a waist-high barbed wire fence. It was a village of many tents, many camels in a corral, and many goats wandering about. Michael had already counted 35 people, most of them men, but a few women and children. At the center of the village, a dozen palm trees stood around a waterhole the size of a small swimming pool, which was obviously very jealously guarded. On the far side of the village was a second watchman's tower.
How the hell do we get into that?
After nightfall, one of us walks in. He allows himself to be captured. He causes some kind of disturbance while his mission team gets through the wire. It's up to him to find the tent where the guns and ammo are stored. If there are grenades, the place can be blown. Then everyone's on their own to get their water.
Mission team?
That's right. You and the boy.
You are mad.
You'll know the time to cross the wire. Take both guns, I won't need one.
You're going in without a gun? Ah, yeah. In English's plan. Make sure you douse yourself with your aftershave and have a spot of tea before you go in.
There's no other way but my way. Can you smell that? The scent of sweet water.
I can't smell anything, and neither can you.
Oh, yes I can.